Welcome to Useful Idiots. I'm your host, Katie Halper.
And I'm Aaron Maté. Hey, everybody. Thank you for joining us. It's great to have you here. Our website, as always, is usefulidiotspodcast.com. This week, we have George Galloway, the veteran peace activist and longtime member of parliament in the UK, who's just returned with a stunning victory on the back of outrage over the genocide in Gaza. He's now returned to parliament, and he's once again acting as a thorn in the side of the pro-war establishment. So we're going to talk to him about his return to office and a lot more.
So excited to talk to him. His great Scottish accent. Not to objectify him. Yeah. All right. Well, there are no movies you saw because you don't really do pop culture. I think last we spoke, I had already seen all the nominees. So, I will say that I will recommend The Zone of Interest. It's a great movie. It's up for Best Picture. It's German, but it's up for Best Overall Picture, not Foreign Film. And what's so interesting about it is that it's about a family, and it's a fictionalized true story about the family that lives next to the camp Auschwitz, basically. They're a Nazi family, and they live next to Auschwitz, and they act like everything's normal. And so a lot of people are drawing the comparison to Gaza and the way that Israelis live like everything's normal right there.
Yeah. And I heard that one of the film's producers recently won an award and actually talked about Gaza of the film.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I hope he still is able to work in the film industry after acknowledging Palestinian humanity, which you're not really allowed to do.
Right. Look at what happened to Susan Sarandon.
Yes. Well, Susan Sarandon is, I think, too big to cancel. Is she not?
I don't know. We'll have to see. I mean, it's such a strong, there's such a strong lobby that I actually think she is, even someone of her stature and fame, I think, is not immune to this.
Well, it comes back to a recurring theme on this show. Israel Zionism ruins everything. It ruins comedy because look at how unfunny Israeli comedy is. And it ruins the film industry if people like Susan Sarandon are punished for speaking out against genocide.
Yeah.
So, you know.
We'll have to wait and see. We'll let you know.
Yeah.
Also, I want to let people know that I'm performing on Friday, March 8th. I'm performing in a show called Laughs for Good. It's a night of laughter and goodwill. And it's a benefit for Doctors Without Borders and the Red Crescent. And it's going to feature great Palestinian food and beverages from Ayat, which is a great restaurant. And you can buy tickets to go live in person, or you can buy Zoom tickets. It's more expensive to go in person. And the event is at 100 Underhill Street in Yonkers, New York. 100 Underhill Street. And it'll be a bunch of great comedians: Maysoon Zaid, Athir Yacoub, Michael Schertzer, Adam Mamawella, and Kansu Karabiak is emceeing. All right, should we get to the four basic food groups?
Yes. What do we have for Democrats Suck?
For Democrats Suck, we have Adam Schiff. Now, in California, the primaries are called jungle primaries, which means that it doesn't matter what party you're in. It's an open primary, and everyone competes against each other, so Republicans and Democrats, and the top two people then go to a runoff election. So if two Democrats win, then they run against each other. If one Democrat wins and one Republican wins, then they go against each other during the general, right? So Adam Schiff was running to replace Dianne Feinstein. And he was running against Katie Porter, Barbara Lee, and a Republican named Steve Garvey. So in the election, Adam Schiff comes in first. Steve Garvey comes in second. So how do you ask, does Steve Garvey come in second when he didn't run a single ad for himself? And he is a former baseball player. Well, he may not have run an ad for himself, but Adam Schiff did. Adam Schiff and his allies spent more than $40 million on ads, and 60% of those ads mentioned Steve Garvey, or in some cases made ads completely about Steve Garvey. And this is all because he knew that he would do better in the general election against Steve Garvey than he would against Katie Porter or Barbara Lee.
They don't call him Shifty Schiff for nothing.
Seriously, so gross.
God, such a scumbag. He's so sleazy.
He's so sleazy, yeah. But that's terrible news that he won. His behavior during the campaign, as well as his behavior just as a as an elected official, has been major Democrat suckage. But there's some good news, which is that his acceptance speech got disrupted by protesters. Let's take a look.
One of the...
Your thing keeps fire now.
I want to thank you all.
Someone came up and said to Adam Schiff, who was reading off a prompter, who was trying to stick to the prompter to wrap it up. He went and finished it up. These were people who came in, about five or six to start with, and said, ceasefire now, ceasefire now. Security ushered them out. And then another couple popped up, let Gaza live, let Gaza live. And then some more came in the middle. Security could not get them out, that they were scattered through the room. Here at the Avalon Theater and the nightclub, and the protesters remain here in the center of this floor. So what was supposed to be a victory celebration and a scripted speech that Adam Schiff was reading off prompter, one no doubt he had carefully crafted a long time ago, was cut dramatically short, and he was now taken off the stage.
And here is another clip of Adam Schiff standing back as a protester gets manhandled and carried out, even though he wasn't doing anything physical. He was just protesting, which is his right to do.
This man is sending your tax dollars to kill children in Gaza. How many more of your tax dollars are sending our tax dollars to Gaza? Free Palestine! Free Palestine! He's killing children with our tax dollars!
Take my money away from the Israeli government! Free Palestine!
If I were Adam Schiff, I would take the declaration of Nancy Pelosi, who recently said that people protesting for a ceasefire are really paid by Russia. And then I would invoke what he said about that the U.S. aids Ukraine so that we can fight Russia over there and we don't have to fight Russia here.
Yeah.
To basically justify his security people manhandling protesters, because he could say, look, we're just fighting Russians.
That's a good idea.
Yeah, with them. But I'm so happy to see him being protested. He's such a phony. He really co-opted liberal progressive energy in the Trump era to, channel it into like Cold War militarism with the whole Russiagate thing. And of course, because he's a neocon, of course he's going to support the Israeli genocide in Gaza. So it's so heartening to see these brave young people standing up to him and calling him out, because he loves to pretend as if he's progressive, he's liberal.
Right.
He'll march in the gay pride parade. He'll do stuff like that. But when it comes down to it on issues that, entail mass murder, like in Gaza, he's fully a neocon. And so it's so great for that progressive facade that he puts on to be shattered by his own constituents. I'm just sorry that the other constituents have voted for him, because
I know
among his opponents was Barbara Lee, who was the only opponent in the race to call for a ceasefire.
Right.
Barbara Lee has a noble tradition.
War in Afghanistan.
Unfortunately, she's not perfect. She did sponsor recently this really draconian bill to impose murderous sanctions on Syria. I don't know why she did that. Maybe to compensate for being good on Gaza. I don't know. But I'm especially mad at Oakland. If anybody's watching this in Oakland, which is Barbara Lee's area in Alameda County, Adam Schiff got more votes than Barbara Lee. Like, what's going on there with Oakland? I hope the Bay has an explanation for that, because that, to me, it's inexcusable.
Another Democrat suck. Why did Porter run? Why didn't she let Barbara Lee run?
Well, I think she really thought that she could take this seat.
Should have waited and let a real progressive, a more progressive. She also endorsed Kamala Harris. So she's made some mistakes. I mean, including the Syria thing that you just mentioned. But, another interesting thing is that by boosting the Republican in the race, Schiff is not only helping boost a Republican in a very sleazy way and harm his potential would-be Democratic opponents, but he's also emboldening Republicans in general, because now that the race is between him and a Republican, Republicans are going to come out and vote, who otherwise wouldn't have come out to vote if it had just been two Democrats. And that means that they're going to vote for other elections also, like down ballot.
Shifty. I think Donald Trump coined that. And hey, credit where credit's due.
Yeah.
Sure is spot on.
Yeah. And David Dayan has a great piece on this in the American Prospect, by the way, on how shifty Shift is.
All right. Well, for Republicans suck, let's turn first of all to Congress member Chuck Fleischmann, who has become the latest member of Congress from the Republican Party to just openly state that he supports the mass murder of Palestinians. And he did so after being confronted by some activists with Code Pink.
You can tell the Palestinians, I will never support a Palestinian myself.
Why do you support the genocide and all of the war crimes and collective punishment? Are you concerned
about
all
the
children?
Let me make it clear. Let me make it clear. Israel is our ally, will always be our ally.
Even if they commit war crimes?
They are not guilty of genocide, and I will support Israel forever.
So Israel will stay your ally even though they commit genocide?
Even when they kill 30,000 kids?
What they did to the Israeli people on October. Let me tell you a statistic.
Yeah, please.
Israel will exist. The Jewish state will exist.
That's not a statistic.
I just got to point out, as that protester pointed out, it's not a statistic. It's a nice thought. It's a nice sentiment, perhaps, but it's not a statistic.
Math is not my forte, but I'm pretty sure I can also vouch for the fact that that is not a statistic.
Yes, right. So we have a united assessment of that.
A statistic generally has to include a number.
Right.
I didn't hear a number there in
nope.
that remark.
No.
Yes.
It's a Zionist sentiment.
If you're a member of Congress, like, shouldn't you know what a statistic is?
Yeah, seriously.
You know?
Yeah. Someone should run against him with that.
And I will always support Israel. And you can tell the Palestinians, I will never support them. I am a Palestinian myself. Then I will tell you, I will never support you. Yeah. I will tell you to your face.
And you want my cousins to die.
Goodbye, Palestine. We will support Israel forever.
So you are comfortable. This guy just said goodbye to Palestine.
So you just said goodbye to Palestine. So you are saying you are comfortable with the murder of thousands of children.
The Jewish people will never suffer again under Palestinian terrorism, under Hamas, under Hezbollah.
What about
Israel
30,
will be secure forever.
Okay.
God bless Israel forever.
Thank you for wiping Palestine off the earth.
God bless Israel forever.
Again, will he be censured for telling a Palestinian that he wants the Palestinians to go by and he wants them wiped off the map? No. You just censure Rashida Tlaib because she calls for equality in Palestine. That's how it works in Congress these days.
He also gave away the game. Like, people like him usually try to pretend that they're for Israel, but not against Palestinians, mm-hmm. which obviously they are, because if you're supporting Israel's genocide against Palestinians, you're not supporting Palestinians. But he just says it, like, goodbye, Palestine. He'll never support Palestinians.
All right, Chuck Fleischman. Well, before you read up on your Israel-Palestine, which definitely needs some edification, you also should read up on what a statistic is,
exactly.
For sure. Yeah. Let's turn to also another Republican, Donald Trump. Donald Trump has been quiet about this Gaza massacre, while, of course, his former ambassador to Israel, David Friedman, has been openly celebrating it and, you know, bragging that it was their policies that kind of helped bring all this to fruition with moving the embassy to Jerusalem, recognizing Israel's annexation of the Golan Heights, you know, just giving Israel full impunity. And certainly they contributed to this current moment we're in. But Trump's been quiet himself, but he showed up on Fox and Friends, and finally he was asked about Gaza. And this is what he said.
About your policies for a second. As you know, this president of the United States, when it comes to Israel, is getting protested. Now he seems to be turning on Israel. But with the non-committed vote that Biden's getting, they're not going to like you either, because you are firmly in Israel's camp, correct?
Just to be sure, Mr. President, like, you're also pro-genocide, right? Like, can you assure us of that? Like, you know, can you just make sure we tell all the anti-genocide people right. that you're pro-genocide?
Lest anyone have any doubts, please reassure us.
Well, he will.
Are you on board with the way the IDF is taking the fight to in Gaza?
You've got to finish the problem. You had a horrible invasion. It took place. It would have never happened if I was president, by the way. As you know, Iran was broke, Brian. They were broke. They had no money for Hamas, for Hezbollah. They were broke. This would have never happened. And for another reason, they wouldn't have done it to me. I guarantee you that. They did this because they have no respect for Biden. And frankly, they got soft. And what happened here is incredible. That should never have happened. Likewise,
if only Donald Trump was in office, Hamas wouldn't have carried out a carefully planned guerrilla operation to resist a multi-decade military occupation because they would have been so intimidated by Donald J. Trump in the White House that they wouldn't have dared to do that.
Unbelievable.
You can tell he's not like fully enthusiastic about endorsing the genocide. Probably because he recognizes that Joe Biden's in trouble because of it. So he wants to like ride that wave a little bit and pretend as if he might do something different. Yeah. But he gives it away when he says that you have to finish the job.
Which means what?
Like wipe out everybody in Gaza? Right. Is that what he means? And then, of course, he makes everything about himself.
Yeah. But I mean, it is what Israel's doing now, and Biden is standing by. So I am curious. I guess he could potentially give them more aid. Like, how would you be even worse?
It's going to be so cringe when these two have to debate. I mean, just the fact that they're debating will be cringe in itself. Yeah. But then they're going to be debating over who is more anti-Palestinian and more devoted to Israel. That's going to be the debate.
More of a sociopath.
Yeah. Not like, you know, hey, President Biden, you support genocide. I'm going to do something different. Trump's going to argue that Biden was like insufficiently supportive of Israel. That's going to be the Republican line of attack. It's going to be just awful.
Well, for isn't that weird? Let's take a look at a videotape about a man who just broke a world record for Big Mac consumption.
Oh, no.
I love hamburger like no other food. I have eaten 32,340 Big Macs in my lifetime. I'm closing in on 50 years next year of eating them every day. This is a McDonald's Big Mac. It's the best sandwich in the world. When I like something, I stick with it all the time. My habit right now is just to eat two a day, and that would be like 14 a week. The obsession with Big Macs began because, for one thing, my love of hamburger.
By the way, I really appreciate his haircut. It's like a decoy. It looks like just bangs in the front. And then lo and behold, he turns around. He's got a whole ponytail. It's like two hairdos in one.
He has a flowing mane. And my thought is like, what if eating Big Macs is the cure for hair loss?
Oh, yeah. Because he has a lot of hair. You're right.
Yeah. If you eat a Big Mac or two Big Macs a day, you'll have a flowing mane like him.
Right. You know? Well, he did. He used to eat 9 a day and then he lowered it to 2 a day. So imagine how much more hair he would have had if that theory is right.
1972 is the day I got my first car. I drove to McDonald's. I ordered my first 3 Big Macs, went out in the car and ate them. And I said right there that I'm going to probably eat these the rest of my life. And I threw the cartons in the back seat and started counting them from day one.
This is 2006, 2007, 2008, 2009, 10, 11, 12, 13, and so on.
How I keep track of how many Big Macs I've eaten is, for one thing, I save the cartons.
You know, he's also 70. He looks pretty good for 70.
He does. I do think McDonald's should do the right thing and cut him off, though. Say, all right, you know, you're cut off.
What if they cut him off and his hair started falling out and his skin started turning really old, like crinkly, and he started looking really old?
Well, then we know what is the fountain of youth. It's Big Macs. There's only one way to find out, which is for him to stop eating them every day.
Yeah.
But, you know, listen, to each their own. Obviously, it brings him a lot of joy. He's kept a meticulous record of all the Big Macs. It's impressive. His dedication.
And the number is 34,128.
Wow. It's a lot of Big Macs.
Yeah. His wife didn't know at first. He kept it a secret.
Wow. Yeah. Well, that's a problem, is it not?
That's a problem. Yeah. Yeah. How soon, like after meeting, do you think you should bring that up? Like how many dates in?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, it'd be in his interest to like lock it down first, you know, put a ring on it.
Oh yeah.
Get married and then drop the news because, you know, someone understandably might not want to be with someone who eats obsessively 2 Big Macs or 3 Big Macs a day. I mean, you know, that's a fair concern.
Yeah. But then you'd have to be like eating on the DL.
Yeah. It's always impressive to see what people are into, and that's his thing. All right. Isn't that terrible? We're going to turn back to the Gaza genocide, which is the topic of constant protests around the country. Noble people coast to coast getting up to confront our politicians for supporting mass murder. And Senator Kirsten Gillibrand became the latest recipient of a protest at a city council meeting in Brooklyn. And one audience member did not like the interruptions from these people opposed to genocide. And he raised his voice in a protest of his own.
Yeah.
We're sending billions of our taxpayer dollars to kill children and women. 30,000 people have been
Stop! I mean, so, I'd like to think he was saying stop the genocide, but that's not what he was saying.
He was not saying stop the genocide. He was saying stop the protest of the genocide.
Yeah.
And for our audio audience, what you can't see is his poor wife sitting next to him.
Yeah.
And she's telling him to stop with her eyes, but right. he's not stopping. And he even looks at her. He can tell she doesn't like him yelling stop, but he can't stop. He can't stop saying stop.
And she's patting his hand, trying to calm him down. And yeah. his face is very red also.
Yeah.
There's actually another clip from that same event. Can we
another clip? One? Stop.
Yeah,
I know. Stop. Stop.
Stop. Stop.
Palestinian children need to be killed. How many? I have a question. Sit down.
Wow. He's saying, sit down. He stands up and says it to the guy standing up behind him. Yeah.
He's really like a rhythmic counter protester. Like, you know, stop, sit down.
You know, he'd be good at protests. He could like chant. He could keep chant going.
Yeah. Or it's like a jazz man. You know what I mean? You know, stop. You know what I mean? Like he's got like, you know, he's got a little flow to him. And I say go on tour. I say go on tour, sir. You know, go to protests around the country and you know, it'd be entertaining.
You know, it'd be good if he joined forces with that Republican congressman.
Jeff Fleischman?
Fleischman. And they could do like, it would be very kind of spoken word. Goodbye, Palestine. Stop.
Yeah.
Stop. Sure. I'll support Israel forever. Stop. And they both are kind of manic, but one's manic in a rhythmic way and one is manic in a more improvisational way.
Mm-hmm.
Could be good.
And also Chuck Fleischman, I'm sure, could learn from this guy what a statistic is. So.
Exactly. Yeah, that guy looks like he knows what a statistic is.
He definitely
is.
Does. Yeah. He definitely does.
Well, those have been your four basic food groups.
For this week's guest, we are joined by George Galloway. He is a British politician and broadcaster. He's just been elected as a member of parliament for Rochdale on the ticket of the Workers' Party of Britain, which he's led since 2019. Prior to that, he spent nearly three decades in parliament, mostly as a member of the Labour Party, and became well known for challenging war, especially the Iraq War. To the point where he even came over to the U.S. and testified before the Senate, where he called out the U.S. invasion and sanctions on Iraq.
Senator, in everything I said about Iraq, I turned out to be right and you turned out to be wrong. And 100,000 people have paid with their lives, 1,600 of them American soldiers, sent to their deaths on a pack of lies, 15,000 of them wounded, many of them disabled forever on a pack of lies.
And now George Galloway is back in office, again challenging U.S.-led warmongering, especially in Gaza, which he mentioned in his victory speech.
Keir Starmer, this is for Gaza. You have paid and you will pay a high price for the role that you have played in enabling, encouraging, and covering for the catastrophe presently going on in occupied Palestine in the Gaza Strip.
So that is George Galloway in his recent victory speech, and now he's been sworn into office. So we're going to hear from him now what he has in store now that he's back in Parliament once again to challenge the pro-war establishment in the UK and around the world. George Galloway, thank you so much for joining us.
A pleasure. Lovely to be here. Both of you are heroes of mine.
Well, likewise. And let's start with your return to Parliament. You were a longtime member of the British Parliament for nearly three decades. You've been out for now close to a decade. You've just returned. Talk to us about why you decided to come back and how you pulled this off.
Well, as the Steve Van Zandt character in The Sopranos used to say, I was out, and they pulled me back in. And that's exactly what has happened. The constellation of circumstances, the accruing betrayal, I've got to use that word, by the Labour Party of any semblance of even even-handedness on the Gaza affair, the increased alienation of millions of former Labour voters with the robotic party leader Sir Keir Starmer, and the apostasy, the wholesale betrayal of everything Labour is supposed to stand for, including the political assassination of his predecessor, Jeremy Corbyn, who's now been banished to not even run a power station in Ulaanbaatar. He is in the frozen wastes, might as well be in Siberia. So all of these things came together and the by-election occurred. And I knew the area very well. My daughter was born very near there. Two of my sons live very near there. I am, for my sins, a Manchester United football supporter, and therefore always in the greater Manchester area every couple of weeks for the games and so on. So I wasn't, in fact, I was the least foreign of the candidates, of the main candidates anyway. There were some local, very local, independent campaigns. But the Labour candidate had come from, a more foreign background than I. He's a councillor in Lancashire, the leader of the Lancashire County Council. And you'd have to know that these regional identities in this part of England are quite sharply drawn. And the other candidates disappeared. The Conservative candidate literally went on holiday during the campaign and only just got back in time for polling day. The Labour candidate was then defenestrated and disowned by the National Party, although he kept campaigning and so on. So it was a set of circumstances almost written in the stars. And so I'm back, warmly received by all the staff. Quite strange, hugging a policeman with a gun in his hand, and all the other staff in the parliament, absolutely delighted to see me, particularly the Hansard writers who write up the speeches. They made a very big point of saying they'd missed my speeches in the House. But from the other members, well, not so much. A kind of icy calm between me and the other members of parliament.
Well, one person who is not welcoming your return to Parliament is the Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak. And in a speech right after you won, he called your victory very alarming.
And it is beyond alarming that last night the Rochdale by-election returned a candidate who dismisses the horror of what happened on October the 7th, who glorifies Hezbollah.
So that's the Prime Minister of Britain welcoming you, George, back to Parliament by freaking out. Why is he so concerned?
Well, it was surreal, actually, and literally unprecedented. It has never happened before that a Prime Minister has denounced the voters of a constituency that's just returned a member with a crushing majority in a by-election. Make matters worse, he actually flew to London to do it. And worse still, he flew in a Royal Air Force jet, so the taxpayers had to pay for him to pull off that stunt. No one can quite work out what it actually means. It wasn't a precursor to anything. You know, he smiled warmly at me in the House at Prime Minister's Question time yesterday, gave me a nod. So it's not wasn't a precursor to being shunned or anything like that. So my inference is, not everyone agrees, that they are preparing the ground for, a kind of khaki election, the whipping boy of Muslims, demonstrators, protesters. The democratic upsurge over the Gaza issue will become one of the sub-themes, at least, of the election. I can only imagine that was the reason for it, so he can keep referring back to it. But if the May election doesn't look as likely now today as it looked a day or two before because of the nature of the budget that has been proposed. And if the election is postponed, therefore, until the autumn, perhaps even October or even November, then I'm not sure how he's going to keep that up. But you may get a raft of measures cutting back on people's rights to demonstrate, maybe a proposal to stop the number of demonstrations you can have. So if you had one this Saturday, you can't have one for two or three or four Saturdays later. Maybe that kind of thing. It remains to be seen. It's up in the air. There's all kinds of talk about Muslim organizations being banned, about parliamentarians being banned from engaging with organizations, perfectly legal ones in Britain, like the Palestine Solidarity Campaign, for example. Well, good luck with that one. They better have a lot of cells, because I'm not sure how many members of the British Parliament, who are quite jealous of their parliamentary privilege and so on, are going to agree to an unelected prime minister telling them who they can engage with, who they can speak to. If they tried to apply it to me, well, they'd have to throw me in jail.
You're being accused of being a kind of rabble-rouser. Well, no, you are a rabble-rouser, so that's appropriate in a good sense. But you're being accused of creating a kind of threat. We hear this a lot in the United States as well. If you have certain views on Israel, you're like a hate monger, creating dangerous spaces. But you yourself suffered a violent attack over being an outspoken defender of Palestinians and critic of Israel. Could you talk about that and whether all these people concerned about safety said anything when that happened?
Yes, that's why I'm wearing this hat, because of a serious assault that hospitalized me in 2014 with my wife and child there. My child was only a few weeks old, in fact, while his father was being mercilessly beaten on the ground by a man wearing an Israeli army uniform. He was 6 weeks before that a Roman Catholic BBC executive with a heroin habit. And 6 weeks later, he had converted to Judaism, donned an IDF uniform, and almost killed me. He went to prison for, I think, 20 months, and then he was flown in a hail of adulation to a kibbutz in Israel to rest and recuperate. There was a big fundraising drive for him. Many people openly said that, you know, he should have finished the job and so on. And so I find it hard to take when people say that about threats against members of parliament, because none, I mean none, big round zero, of the mainstream political figures or the mainstream media covered this assault at all. Although I was a sitting member of parliament at the time, it was in 2014, at the time of an earlier iteration of Gaza slaughter, and it was directly related to that. As a matter of fact, I was assaulted three times in 4 months. Three people were convicted. The other two were not nearly as serious, but three times in 4 months for a sitting member of parliament. And nobody did anything about it at all. And only Peter Oborn on the BBC took it seriously at all and made the point that if it can happen to me, it can happen to others. And guess what? So it did happen to others with fatal consequences. Two of my parliamentary colleagues were in subsequent years murdered for political reasons. And if they had taken the assault upon me more seriously, well, no one can know, but there might have been a better chance that my colleagues would now not be laid in an early grave.
And can you explain, so you wear the hat because there was...
my head was quite badly scarred. And you know me, Katie, I like to look my best. So I donned the fedora, and it became a kind of trademark. Yeah. And so I've kept it. There are still some scars, but I'm not allowed to wear my hat in the House of Commons. So I'm there bare for all to see.
even though the conservative prime minister Sunak called you out and said he was alarmed by your victory, I don't think the leader of the Labour Party, your former party, Keir Starmer, is any more of a fan of you. And in your victory speech, you specifically called him out, saying that your victory was for Gaza.
Keir Starmer and Rishi Sunak are two cheeks of the same backside. And they both got well and truly spanked tonight here in Rochdale.
What is the message that you intend to bring to Keir Starmer and the Labour Party now that you're back as his colleague in Parliament?
Well, if you'd listened carefully, you would have heard the knees knocking of Sir Keir Starmer, the Labour leader, because he is the biggest loser, not Sunak, whose party was humiliatingly crushed in an area where they've never represented it. But Labour has represented the town for effectively 100 years. It's where the co-op was born in 1844, which became a great international idea. And Labour is in the timber of the town, and that's part of the problem. The town has gone downhill. Labour is blamed for it. And now they're in very big trouble, and not just in our town. They're in big trouble up and down the country. Obviously, in areas where there are high numbers of young people, where there are high numbers of ethnic minority communities, where there are educated people in clusters around universities and so on. These are all places now that Labour might well be punished at the ballot box in the general election. So all their calculations have now gone awry. They were counting on people who had voted for them generation after generation, continuing to do so on the basis they had nowhere else to vote. Now there is somewhere else to vote. And, it's growing like wildfire. I now have more than 300 people wanting to stand at their own expense as Workers' Party candidates in the general election. Many of them eminent people, well-known people, powerful people in their own local communities. So we threaten, I was going to say dozens, but really it's scores and scores of Labour parliamentary seats. Either we win them, or we at least make sure Labour lose them. And we're unapologetic about that, Aaron. We don't believe in the politics of the lesser of two evils. That way, evil always wins. And anyway, how do you discern which is the lesser of two evils between Sunak and Starmer, any more than you can between Biden and Trump? Extraordinarily similar, our situations, you know, in that regard. Oscar Wilde was right. We are two countries divided by a common language, but we are increasingly a singular polity, I would argue, with the same issues, the same kind of leaderships, and the same need for an alternative.
The massacre in Gaza is obviously on all of our minds right now. When you decided to run, and as you campaigned, how big of a factor do you think that was in your decision and ultimately in your victory? And what are you seeing out there in terms of how this genocide is galvanizing people and getting more people to be involved in politics and caring once again about war, which, you know, speaking of your political orientation, you know, not wanting to associate quite with the left anymore, that's something that the left broadly in the Western world, at least, is not talking about as much as it used to, which is opposing war.
It was a huge part in my decision to stand. It was a significant part, maybe also huge part of the reason why I was elected with the majority that I got, and it is a huge issue amongst the general public. Obviously, not every member of the general public. Israel has some supporters, not that many, and apathy has rather more supporters. But there's millions of us in Britain who are so deeply affected, traumatized, actually, by what's happening and what we can see to be happening. There's never been anything like this, has there? Where every time we switch on our telephones, we we have access to the most appalling, heartbreaking, heart-wrenching things that we're seeing more or less in real time. So, I mean, if you're not affected by that, I mean, are you even alive? It's massive. Going to remain massive, I think, whatever happens with laughing gas Harris's 6-week humanitarian pause. It's still going to be massive right up to the general election and beyond, and in the years to come. I've been involved in the Palestinian issue for more than 50 years, and I've never known a level of consciousness and solidarity around the Palestinian cause as I experience now every day. And if there are millions of us, that is a powerful political force. If it can be organized in just a few months in the elections, then it can have an enormous political impact. You know, our politics is a bit easier than yours because we don't have the same money issues. You can only spend about $15,000 on a parliamentary election, and most people are able to raise that from amongst their own friends and crowdfunding and so on. So there's no AIPAC in the pick. There's no political action committees. There's no hundreds of millions, even billions of dollars like you've got. So our politics is a bit easier to organize in such a way that you can make an impact. And if we can change the result in 60, 80 parliamentary seats, then we'll be the real winners of the general election. Whoever ends up with the greater number of seats, it will be us that made all the weather.
I remember after the Israeli blockade of Gaza began around 2007, you traveled to Gaza to break the blockade. And you did so with a really bold action by basically handing over money to Gaza's Ministry of Health in defiance of this crushing siege on the people of Gaza. And I was struck by what a courageous act that was, especially given your history, because back when you were challenging the sanctions on Iraq, you also were falsely accused then of somehow being financially tied to the Iraqi government. Which you were libeled over in the British media. So I'm just wondering if you could reflect on that experience. What drove you to do it? And did you face any consequences as a result of breaking the siege of Gaza?
No consequences. I led a convoy of well over 100 trucks and vans and ambulances and so on. To break the siege on Gaza. In fact, I did it several times, including one from the United States. We were the first in 2008 to break the siege. That's how long this siege has been going on, by the way. It was imposed on the people of Gaza because of how they voted in a free and fair election. I'm not myself a supporter of Hamas. Their politics are not my politics. I was very close to President Arafat for decades. I was at his deathbed in Paris when he passed away. And I was with him from 1977 when I first traveled to meet the Palestinian cause there and then in the refugee camps in Beirut in 1977. So I was with Arafat for a long time. I'm not a supporter of Hamas. We were handing over aid, including money, to the Ministry of Health in Gaza, which, of course, the Ministry of Health, because Hamas were the government, you could be forgiven for the headline, "I'm handing over cash to Hamas," but I wasn't. I was handing it over to the Ministry of Health. And we did it because we have an old-fashioned belief that every people must choose their own leaders, and that it cannot be that British and American statesmen, women, pick the leaders of other countries, and if the wrong leaders are elected, well, pile on the economic agony, isolation, and so on. That's not a form of international relations we can accept.
Can you talk about Great Britain's role in the proxy war in Ukraine and in the genocide in Gaza, both Great Britain's role and what impact it's having on Great Britain?
Well, once upon a time, Tony Blair brought the deployment of British troops to Iraq in that case before the parliament and allowed us a vote on whether or not we wanted to do that. And of course, the fools by majority voted to do that. But at least Blair gave parliament a choice. Even David Cameron in 2014, when he wanted to bomb the Syrian Republic, brought it before Parliament for a vote. I know very well because we beat him. We stopped it by a parliamentary victory, and I was one of the speakers in that debate. I remember it well. So again, Cameron wanted to take Britain to war against Syria, but at least he put it before the Parliament. Nowadays, we're learning in the most obscure ways, bizarre ways, that we've got forces deployed in other people's wars all over the place. So, for example, yesterday, the English press reported that five special forces soldiers of ours had been arrested on return to England on war crimes charges in Syria. Now, we didn't even know they were in Syria, let alone allegedly committing war crimes. And we only learn of it because they've been arrested. We learn from the static that was picked up by the Russians, the conversation with these German generals plotting to attack a bridge in Russia. What could possibly go wrong? Has that happened before? I hear a distant voice asking myself. We learn from that there are British forces on the ground helping to target some of these missile attacks, which are effectively terrorist attacks. That bridge was a civilian target. The people killed on it were civilian people. It could only with the most extreme license be described as a legitimate military target, but the British were involved, according to the German generals, in the targeting of these strikes, other strikes, Belgorod and others. It's said that the British were involved in helping the Zelensky forces to murder civilians, which is a crime. Whoever does it, against whomsoever it is done. And so I've got to say, the British appear to be at war everywhere. Not a world war, but war across the world.
And just to explain for people what was mentioned there in terms of this leaked German recording, it just came out. We haven't discussed this yet on the show, but it's very important. It just came out in the Russian media, which obtained an intercepted conversation of German generals talking about how to deliver their missiles to Ukraine for use, even though the German Chancellor Scholz said, we're not going to deliver those missiles. So this could be these German generals plotting how to circumvent their own elected leader, which raises questions in itself. And they also say that there are Western forces, British forces, French forces, American forces on the ground secretly helping Ukraine with targeting and the use of their missile systems, even though all these countries deny that publicly. Let me ask you about another British figure very involved in Ukraine, which is Boris Johnson. It's now well known that he sabotaged or helped sabotage a peace deal early on in this war between Russia and Ukraine when he came over to Kyiv and told Zelensky that we're not going to back you up if you make peace with Russia, you should keep fighting. And that's exactly what happened. Your assessment of his role in all this, and has he responded yet to your victory?
Well, he was sent like a big old English sheepdog by Joe Biden, of course, to go and tell Zelensky to stay in his lane. It wouldn't be Johnson acting independently, neither Zelensky taking orders from Britain. Who does? It would be a message that was being delivered by Joe Biden. And you describe it absolutely correctly. That's what happened. We know that from now dissident Ukrainian officials, high officials, who told us about it, who were there. No, Boris Johnson's no longer in Parliament. He's making millions on his post office immoral earnings, a bit like Tony Blair. Is one of the problems in Britain. I caution your own country against it in this understandable anxiety people have about old guys being political leaders. It can actually be even worse having young guys, because they then get to leave office and profit for decades from the decisions that they made when they were in office. And that's what happened with Tony Blair. It's what happened with David Cameron, though he's now back in politics in an unelected position as Foreign Secretary. But it will definitely be said to have been Boris Johnson's, I don't know, he's built a war chest, but it wasn't for the Ukrainians. It was for himself.
And what about the Houthis?
Yes. Well, the Houthis sent a letter to Rishi Sunak just after I was elected, saying that the only person they trusted to negotiate was me, and that I must send anything Sunak sends to them has to be countersigned by me. I don't know why they did that. I don't think ill of them for doing it. But I have told David Cameron that if you want me to do anything to help get this ship salvaged, I'm ready to do it. But a much quicker way would be to end the siege on Gaza, send the British aid that I presume is amongst the thousands of trucks locked outside the Rafah gate. Why don't you put a British flag on that column and drive it right in there now? Who's going to stop you? And that's the best way to unblock the shipping lanes in the Red Sea.
Another socialist politician, well known, is of course Jeremy Corbyn, a longtime colleague of yours. You were a supporter of his when he was heading the Labour Party. But as now we've all seen, he was sabotaged from within, from people including Keir Starmer, with a ridiculous smear campaign labeling him and his supporters as anti-Semites. And one thing I noticed is you, while supporting Corbyn, were also critical of him for not punching back hard enough, for sort of catering to the smear campaign rather than calling it out as the scam that it was. And I'm wondering if you just talk to us about, you know, your criticisms of Corbyn in that way, and do you plan on working with him now that you're back together in Parliament?
And to hear the rest of the interview, please go to usefulidiotspodcast.com.
That was great. Such a great guest.
Yes, and I'm just so thrilled he's back in office, making trouble, speaking truth, and as only he can. He's got such a way with words.
It really does. Also, make sure you check him out on his own show called Moat, Mother of All Talk Shows, which is a great show.
That's right. You've been a guest on that before.
Yeah. Yeah. It's great. He's a great interviewer and interviewee.
Yeah. And maybe, you know, he invited us to join him in Parliament. So maybe we'll find ourselves doing a Useful Idiots show from London.
That would be great.
Who knows? Yeah.
Who knows? Yeah.
All right. Well, that's our show. Our website is usefulidiotspodcast.com. Go there to support the show and get bonus content, including the extended interview we did with George Galloway. And we'll see you next time.
Bye, everyone.
Thanks so much for listening to and watching Useful Idiots. For extended episodes, bonus content, and our weekly Thursday Throwdown episode, please subscribe at usefulidiotspodcast.com. Support the show for free by subscribing on YouTube, Rumble, and wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like the podcast, don't forget to rate and review. You can also follow us on Twitter at Useful Idiot Pod. Thanks for supporting independent media. We'll see you next time.